All right, today on the podcast, we have John Taylor. John is a deep thinker. Our discussions typically span a wide array of topics. We've been having these discussions for quite some time because he's my cousin. And I wanted to do an introduction here because we actually had this discussion in February this past winter. So this was, we were talking about the freedom convoy that was going on, the COVID restrictions, vaccines, some stuff like that. So in case you thought these topics were coming out of left field, they were fairly timely this past winter. Hope you guys enjoy it. Human knowledge and practices and things that work, they were discovered through trial and error. Mm-hmm. And then they were adopted many times, I think, well before you could articulate them.
Yeah.
Or the benefits of them. Or why.
Yeah.
Or even certainly the science behind it.
Definitely. Yeah. It's the same with natural evolution. I think that cultural evolution, the evolution of ideas, and even the way our minds work to a certain degree is very much like that. At least for most people, most of the time, it's not consciously thought out. It is trial and error. Like we were saying on the other podcast about wisdom, it's something that kind of emerges with time. Like, you can't teach it. It's something that you just get.
Mm.
And I think the way that you get wisdom, just as one example, is through trial and error. It's the experience of seeing how things tend to play out and internalizing that, so that on a visceral level, when you think about what you have to do, you know the best choice to make long term or short term, even whatever the time frame is that makes sense, given your experience in life and how those experiences have built up.
Right. And that's why I think that's why literature and these wisdom traditions that are written down are so important, because you can do it, because you can't do it in one lifetime.
No.
You have to stand on the shoulders of giants. And you have to, even just as simple as watching movies and watching how those characters and their karma works and their life unfolds based on their decisions and if it rings true or not, you have to expose yourself to that, or else you fall into too many pits and to end up with the life that you wanted.
Yeah, no, I think that you do need to have something that's timeless, you know, that's time tested, not because the fact that it's old makes it good in and of itself, but because it tends to be true that things that have been around for a long time and have survived the incredibly tumultuous story of the history of our human race are stronger and more powerful than things that we come up with that might work and might not. Now, that's, as you know, that's obviously an evolutionary strategy. Like
conservatism.
Yeah, exactly. Conservatism.
Yep.
And liberalism too, you know, high risk, high reward strategy, where you come up with a unique idea and on the rare occasion when it works, it pays off big time.
Right.
So it's like there's nothing wrong with, you know, creativity and stepping away from the norm. Actually, that's one of the most amazing things about human beings, in my opinion. But it's not the only strategy. And I think that for all of us in times of our lives, we need both.
Yes.
Just as we were saying.
And society needs both.
Yeah. Yeah. Just as we were saying in the other podcast, you know, that, you know, we have all of these different personalities for a reason and different political points of view and stuff like that for a reason. Even in our own lives, I think sometimes you need the conservative strategy. Sometimes you need the liberal strategy or whatever you want to call it. You need to approach things in different ways. And actually, I think wisdom in some ways is, it's not just conservatism. It's also knowing when to be conservative, when to experiment.
Right. It's a different plane.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a sense in which you're aware of which action would be better given the constraints that you have. And, you know, you can't always say why.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, experience doesn't just teach you to kind of hold fast to traditions or, you know, established ways of doing things. Sometimes wisdom tells you when you're digging in your heels.
Right.
And,
yeah,
you know, reminds you to, you know, maybe open your eyes a little bit, look to the horizon, try different things.
Yeah. And there's no, there's like, there, yeah, it really is case by case and based on the scenario. You know, there might be entire lifetimes where you have to try novel things. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking lately, like, that you don't, if you want to lead a good life, I'm very grateful for both very conservative people in society and very creative people mm-hmm. in society, because they both benefit society.
Yes.
Now, being a very creative person, being on either end of the spectrum might not lead to a good life for that individual.
Isn't that funny?
But I feel grateful that it contributes to the whole yeah. of society. Now, if you go to the individual analysis of the thing, do you, like, you almost, you don't, it, and maybe you just play life by your nature and live life by what, you know, how you were born and then the nature of your individual being. But you almost, you want to understand the conservative position before you go and push the envelope.
Yeah, I think so. I think the reason for that is because in life, things aren't willy-nilly. Like, there's laws of nature, there's strategies that follow certain patterns, even when they vary widely across time. And often creativity is only triggered when you're given some kind of limitation to work within. And in fact, the mind works quicker because you know there's all these things that you can't do. So it's like, how do I find my way out of this problem? And you're going into overdrive. If you had no constraints, it was like, all right, let's be really creative and just do whatever we want. And that's going to be our way of creating art. That's our exercise. You know, just do whatever you want. Be creative. It's like, even if someone tells you that and you end up producing something great, it's because you set yourself goals and you give yourself limitations. And so, you know, that's where, you know, following the conservative wisdom comes in. I think when it comes to characters and stories too, like, there's certain arcs that resonate with us. And we know when something's off. Mm. When we read a piece of fiction or watch a movie where something doesn't ring true, it's because there's something about human nature that hasn't been depicted correctly. And so that's why practicing on the old ideas is such a good idea at first. Mm-hmm. But then I think that there's so much value in going beyond the boundaries.
Sure.
That, you know, messing up a lot is absolutely a price worth paying. Now, is it a price infinitely worth paying? No. Mm-hmm. There are circumstances in which it doesn't make sense. But it's a price worth paying some of the time, and more often than most people,
yes,
you know, will you
allow
know
themselves
will allow themselves, because yeah. most people, I don't think, are creative in practice, but have a spark in them that could manifest. Mm. Maybe it's not a lot, mm-hmm. but they have something in them. It's just that they're too timid, or they're in a situation in life where they haven't had any reason to unleash it.
Sure.
But it can come out in extraordinary circumstances. And I think that while people are different, and some people are just more creative than others, and I think that's totally fine, if someone finds as an individual that maybe they're stuck in a rut in life, I think that it's a good idea to try and train that creative side of your brain a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can do that in small ways, like, it could be anything as simple as, you know, cooking in a different way. Like, let's mix up the recipe a little. You know, maybe not a high level of creativity, but, you know, it's something where you get a tangible reward for it and you can see the benefit. And if it's something new that works, maybe you stick with that and that becomes your new tradition, you know. And just, like, choosing that as an attitude in life. Now, obviously, as we say, then as we have been saying, there's different personalities and different temperaments. And, you know, being creative isn't for everybody.
Oh, of course, yeah.
But I think that it's because it's such a high risk strategy, I think people don't engage in it as much as they might be able to, because they fear failure, and rightly so, because failure can
it hurts a lot somebody. More than success feels good.
Yes, yes, that's the thing. It hurts more than success feels good. But then people, they don't understand that, like, nobody that's ever succeeded really big time ever did so without failing over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you don't let yourself fail,
you never learn.
You never learn. And you never have the chance to really reach great heights, I think, if you don't do that. Like, that's just a prerequisite. So, you know, like someone who has never failed is someone who has never succeeded. I don't remember who said that, but I think that it's a really good quote.
Yeah, absolutely. Quote. Yeah, no, I don't know who it was. Yeah, I mean, that's and that's why I think encouraging more and more people to have discussions, just to have discussions, or to, like I previously have encouraged you to start a podcast,
right,
is to have these, because a failure within a discussion really doesn't hurt.
No.
You know, yeah, someone in the YouTube comments section is going to say something that might hurt a little bit.
Right.
But it might be true.
Right. And it might also be something you need to learn and listen to.
Right. And I think public speaking is so incredibly feared.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the downside is so little.
I mean,
when you really analyze it.
Because, I mean, it's words. And yes, words hurt. But the thing is, we've evolved this form of public debate because it's the forum of conflict, in many cases, that hurts the least.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to appreciate that. We have to see this as something precious and something that we're so lucky to be a part of, especially in the modern world where you can contact people from all over the world. And, you know, very often people will be suspicious of it, but like you can message someone on Facebook in a public group or something, someone that you don't know very well, someone that's doing something that seems interesting. Even if they don't have the time to talk, they might point you in the right direction. Maybe
sure.
It's not someone that's super famous, but it's somebody that's doing something you find interesting. Like, you just try, you know, it's amazing how many people will listen, and it's amazing how many people will, you know, keep in contact with you, even occasionally if it's just, you know, commenting on your Facebook page or what have you, or whatever form of social media it is that you're using. Now, I've been trying to take a step back from social media recently. You know, there's a dark side to it, but like, it absolutely does open so much up. You know, it allows us to, you know, reach people with very different views from us. And I just kind of wish that we could do that in a more constructive way than we're doing it now, because everyone says that they want good faith discussion,
yes,
between people from different perspectives. And yet it never seems to happen. It's like, I want a good faith discussion, they say, and then they put up their guard,
mm-hmm,
and they start attacking a bit too much. Mm-hmm. It's probably a universal experience. It's hard to like really be open and humble, as you say, and like want to learn and admit when you might be wrong.
Right. Because I mean, I think there's an evolutionary pressure to be right.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it hurts when you're wrong, because, well, to be wrong 100,000 years ago meant you died, in many cases. So it's like, it is like a small death.
Yeah.
But man, like
you're lucky enough not to have to die a literal death to learn that now.
Well, exactly.
Like, and look at all of the incredible things that evolution has done through that long, difficult process, using death as its scalpel. You know, the fact that we can do that just with parts of our mind and with ideas and parts of our personality is such a precious thing. But, you know, it's funny, we dig in our heels and, you know, we don't always want to change our minds. We're like, I am right about this. Mm-hmm. I said this a while ago, so I have to hold fast to this opinion. Like, mm-hmm, I feel that myself. I admit to it. And it's like, why? Well, because it's humiliating to be wrong. Yeah, but you're also more correct when you admit to that, and that makes you stronger in the end. So why?
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting, because it's actually more humiliating to believe that you're right when you're wrong.
Yeah, it is. It really is, because you look incredibly deluded to the rest of the world, or at least everyone that, okay, I mean, we're not all perfect portals to truth, obviously. The world would be a simpler place to live in if we were, but like, you know, it's like, if you're really obviously wrong about something, people will regard you better when you apologize or you admit that you made a mistake.
Yes.
And you can explain yourself afterwards and say, well, in my defense, this is why I did this.
Yep.
And people are usually open to that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that very often people, myself included, will try and give the defense first because we're so humiliated that we might be wrong about something.
Mm-hmm.
And we launch into the defense, and it makes people look like they're defending the mistake. And you see this happen everywhere. And I've heard a lot of people, very different people, comment on this before.
Hmm.
And it's, you know, it's hard to hear at first, but then you're like, huh, there's something to that. You know, we should actually try to be right more. And with that goes humiliating, you know, feelings of humbleness,
mm-hmm.
and growth and all of that that follows afterwards.
Hmm.
And it's in a sense a duty to ourselves and those that we care about, because we can, yes, you know, you're exposed and you're vulnerable and bad things happen to you. It isn't always good to run your mouth. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, it's always good to admit when you're wrong and to come to a more strong position.
So along those lines, one of my favorite ideas from Terence McKenna is, you know, he'll give this just giant rap on something and then follow it up with, well, I don't actually believe any of this. Right?
Well, that's someone who's highly creative and is like, let's just explore this completely for its own sake.
Yeah.
And isn't it interesting? Yeah. It's like, yeah, but whatever, you know, it's not true.
Well, and yeah, and right? And you're all on board, you're following along,
right,
and
right.
then he'll say, and I don't believe anything. I don't give myself over to belief completely because that precludes the opposite from being true.
Yes. It stops you from seeing in some ways when you take something as dogma. You know, you should always have your eyes open because the world is a complex place, and most people in practice don't ever get a good grasp even of the piece of reality that they see in front of them.
Yes. Well, and you can't.
You can't. You can't possibly.
The world is infinite.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're finite.
And as Aldous Huxley would say, the reducing valve mm-hmm. of the mind mm-hmm. is the size. When you look at the fraction, the equation of infinite mm-hmm. over any number.
Yeah.
Right? The spotlight of our consciousness shows us nothing.
Yeah.
Literally,
yeah.
like, you know.
It's statistically insignificant.
Statistically zero.
Right.
So we're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We're completely wrong. We don't have a firm grip on reality.
Mm-hmm. We don't. It's scary. But we somehow stumble through the world in spite of not having that.
Right.
And I think one thing I was saying the other day is like reality is often what you bump into. So often that's true. Like you only learn when you're like you completely wipe out and it's like, yeah, what I was doing was just not working.
Mm-hmm.
It's often way too difficult because we need our routines to be able to go through life. And
mm-hmm.
and those routines often don't match reality, but they work for us.
Right.
So it's like, that's enough. And you go through your day and, you know, you believe what's expedient for you to get through it. And then all of a sudden, whoops, you got a mistake. Your beliefs are no longer expedient.
Mm-hmm.
You're now in a world where you've messed up
mm-hmm.
and you've stumbled. And then you learn from that mistake, again, trial and error, like we were saying before, and maybe you start acting in a way that doesn't lead to that happening again. And then I think that's where some of the collective wisdom gets built up.
Right. Right. So it's like we don't know what's true, but it's our, you know, our daily life, the guiding principle might be what works.
Yeah, exactly. And I think maybe you could say that we constantly interact with the world, so we're bumping into truth, but we are usually not aware of it.
Mm.
We don't know what we're bumping into.
Mm-hmm.
We stumble along, you know, almost blindly, not fully understanding the kind of world that we're in, and we see this, as you say, statistically insignificant piece of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us will only ever see that through our whole lifetimes as naive beings, small beings, limited beings. But we stumble on, and when we run into the greater world, that's when we know that we know something as much as that's possible
mm-hmm.
for our limited minds. And I think that's fundamentally how you can explain us living in a world where we're connected to everyone and everything. And being ignorant of it. It's not like it's not affecting us on an unconscious level. That's why wisdom often comes on an unconscious level.
Mm.
I think there's a part of our minds that is aware of this kind of greater reality. And you have this synchronicity and all this mystical stuff going on.
Sure.
But being aware that you're aware That's a vanishingly rare thing.
Very rare.
And it almost never happens in our lifetime.
Right.
And those are those eureka moments. Like when,
to know that you know.
To know that you know. When something actually pops through your mind and out, bubbles up from the unconscious into the conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Those moments, rare as they are, when you know that you know, and often you still need to run experiments, you need to live the belief out.
Mm-hmm.
But when you discover something that clicks,
mm-hmm.
that's once in a blue moon. I think that's when the knowledge comes in.
Right.
As close as we can ever get to pure knowledge. Because, of course, if you go down philosophical rabbit holes.
We don't know anything. Yeah.
Right.
What are your thoughts on pursuing meaning? And my interpretation of meaning through someone like, Jordan Peterson would say that meaning is when you're in the flow, when you're in the flow state, when time passes, when you're doing something worthwhile, like when time vanishes. And I think, you know, many other thinkers have said this, but, do you try and pursue those endeavors that give you that feeling?
I mean, I think we all do, just mm-hmm. like on an unconscious level. You know, flow state is, synonymous with the term zone of proximal development. I think a long time ago we were talking about this.
Mm.
That's when
whose idea is that? The zone of proximal development.
Some psychologist. Mm. I don't remember.
Right. So that's when you're you have one foot in what you know and one foot into the unknown that.
That's right. You're just challenged enough.
Yep.
Not too much, not too little, basically. Sure. And that's the flow state because, you know, you get the energy from building on what you know and it's always feeding you and informing you and the excitement of going forward into the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of similar to what flow state is normally seen as. And it's really funny because it's like, I think our self-awareness can be the end of us when we get into that state because sometimes we become aware of it. And at least in my case, I'm like, oh my God, I'm aware of it. And then
bumps
suddenly,
you out of it.
Yeah, you're gone.
Yep.
You're not in it anymore. So it's like, I found with writing, one thing that always helped me was to write when I'm inspired.
Mm.
Now you don't rely on that for any creative endeavor because inspiration comes once in a blue moon, but when you get it, you take advantage of it.
Yes.
And sometimes what you get actually is a lot better than what you have when you're not as inspired
mm-hmm.
and not in that zone of proximal development or flow state or whatever you want to call it. And it's enough of a gem, you know, in the rough
mm-hmm.
of what you're doing that it inspires you to keep hacking away and building on top of it. And,
sure.
you know, creating something to encircle that gem that's worthy of it, if mm-hmm. that makes any sense. Because, you know, it's rare when those gems come.
Right.
And that's good motivation, I think, you know, taking that inspiration that I think comes from the zone of proximal development, seeing it as a gift. And that's how people interpreted it at one point. Like now we call people that we really admire geniuses.
Okay.
But back in the day, you weren't a genius. You had a genius.
Yeah.
Yeah. A teaching spirit basically that would visit you. And, you know, the Greek poets like Hesiod, you know, always invoked the muses
mm-hmm.
at the start.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, the muses are telling me this story and giving it to me.
Because we feel that it does come from the other.
Yes.
That it doesn't come from us. It's a gratuitous thing.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, because I personally, I get those, I'm most often, or I can most readily access the flow state, through racing, through racing and skiing,
mm-hmm.
Because it just demands all of my attention.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how meaningful that is. You know what I mean? And like people get hooked on free climbing, rock climbing, and like, of course that you're going to be in that state when you're climbing, a widowmaker without a rope.
Right.
They
call them widowmakers. Widowmakers for reasons.
Yeah. But then beyond that, I've had twice in my life while racing in the most high stress situation, like on the last lap of a race, running in second, mm-hmm. I need to make the pass.
Mm-hmm.
I've had this witness where I actually witnessed myself doing it. And I could have this a little bit more of knowing that I know. A little bit more of, wow, look at him do that. Look at him, and he's gonna downshift now. And I had this, but it came with this ecstatic physical feeling.
Wow.
Almost like beyond orgasmic, this ecstatic physical feeling.
Like you're shaking all over.
Yeah, and like an awe or something. Body. Yeah, through my whole body.
Wow.
And I've had that twice, but only once go-karting and once in the race car.
Oh, that's great.
And that's it. But I guess, you know, like how do you say that's meaningful?
But then it so obviously is. Like the reaction itself. That you had, the somatic reaction that you had to that mm-hmm. was so intense that it's like, this is meaning. It's like, because you were doing something at your best.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, were you performing any better than you normally
yes.
performed the race?
Yes.
Okay, there you
yes.
go. That's probably what it was. It's like, you had that moment where the inspiration bubbled up from the unconscious and you were able to, you know, make those decisions
mm-hmm.
in real time and be aware of it. Like all the micro decisions that you must make when you're racing.
They're subconscious.
Right.
Like they're so often subconscious.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't like it. You know, it's not some noble pursuit. It's simply I'm conquering the useless when I'm right. racing, like to put it mildly.
Right. Well, you know what? That's so much of what we do as humans. I mean, who really cares? Like the book I'm writing, who really cares at the end of the day? It's just some fun adventure I'm putting together, but it doesn't matter. You know, it's meaningful to us and we care about all these little things as humans. Mm-hmm. So it's like, and because it takes a tremendous amount of skill to race, like it's mm-hmm. it's a high stakes activity. Like most people that do it, I'm sure, like, and you yourself, I know, have, you know, been in wipeouts and stuff like that. So it's like, it's a big risk. So I mean, I imagine like the courage that it takes to go on and do something like that is a huge part of it.
Mm, yeah. I mean, nowadays it's as much courage as golfing, I think, but
oh.
it's still somewhat dangerous, but golfing does that for sure. I can't imagine the pressure those guys feel, and they must feel the same way
oh, yeah.
when they're having a round, like an incredible round of golf or something like that.
Yeah,
putting it together, or like maybe in more in your world, like seeing like a Jordan Peterson lecture. I couldn't imagine getting on stage and winging it.
Yeah,
like the or stand up comedians, like the feeling that you'd get
mm-hmm.
would be incredible. And maybe it's just the alleviation of suffering within the individual's life who experiences it is
right.
what's meaningful.
Well, I mean, we were talking about negative utilitarianism. Like, yeah, there's some people for whom elimination of suffering is everything. But I mean, there is a reason why people have, sometimes in ways that are a bit too over the top, gone for something like that.
Mm.
Because, you know, you need to find meaning in something. Even mm-hmm. if it's just, you know, eliminating suffering. So it's like, and you know, that's a hard enough task, you know, like, because I was really critical of it in that other podcast. But I mean, like, extinguishing suffering is a huge part of a major world tradition, you know, Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
That's so key to it. So it's like, it's not like it's not a hard thing to do in and of itself. That more from the personal perspective
personal.
And the individual perspective yes. and the social perspective.
Yes.
But it's definitely something that takes a lot of time to do.
Do you think it's because, so from that perspective, so say you're able to eliminate quite a large amount of suffering within your own life, and then you're not proliferating karma. Mm. So hurt people hurt people.
Yes. Yes. Unfortunately, and. I don't remember who it was that said that. I've heard.
I have no idea, but I just repeat it all the time.
Oh, okay. Like, yeah, you know, I've heard that too. Like, that's a really profound and sad statement, you know, mm-hmm. but it is true. Hurt people hurt people.
So if you can eliminate
the suffering, people are less bitter and they're going to be more open and charitable and they want to engage you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So maybe it really is worthwhile to, not a happy life, but to lead that meaningful life
mm-hmm.
and to eliminate your own suffering. So that you don't lash out and
yeah.
put karma or put, mm-hmm. you know, put upon other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can, like, I guess that's probably a Buddhist or Hindu type way of thinking, to end your karma, right?
Right.
Is the idea?
Mm-hmm.
Is that, does it, like, to end your karma and then you're done, you're off the wheel?
Well, I mean, you attain in the Hindu way of thinking about things, moksha, liberation.
Okay.
So it's not like you're done your karma, because you can get bad karma or good karma. That's just, you know, what goes around comes around. That's a Western way of putting it, I mm-hmm. guess, but it's like, it's definitely a way of seeing it, I think. And karma is not so much, from what I understand, something to extinguish, but something to bring back round to balance, where like it's not weighing you down anymore. It's pushing up.
It needs to be offset.
Instead. Yeah, it needs to be offset. It's like the wind can be blowing to the east or the west, say, but you want good karma. You want the wind to be blowing to the west. Let's just use that as, you know, a metaphor there. Karma can push you in either direction because it's just the consequence of your action. So you want your actions to you know, reference entropy, like we were doing in the podcast on Gnosticism, go towards extropy instead of entropy.
So what's extropy?
Extropy is a term that's sometimes used to talk about building something more stable, like exponentially and almost miraculously more stable and more thriving and more complex where there was chaos before. So you could think about the universe in general as entropic.
Yes.
But looking at human civilization, in some ways, obviously this is up for debate and we're in a very complex world and there's ups and downs and falls of civilizations and, you know, all that stuff. And we certainly have, you know, environmental problems that can get in the way and political problems and wars. But at the end of the day, the needle points upward on human civilization.
Oh, yeah.
I really believe that. You know, it becomes more and more complex. There's more and more sophistication in it. And so that's extropy. That's the reverse direction than you would often suspect the world would go in. And the universe, even though it is entropic, has this extropic component to it because, you know, basic elements form stars and then galaxies and then planets. And then at least on this planet, life has evolved. So there's an element of the universe that's, I think, maybe equivalent to that Gnostic spark of divinity. It's like the reverse to entropy. It is the extropy.
Well, for sure, the world is getting more and more complex at an ever increasing rate.
Mm-hmm.
So is that why you think the theory of the Big Bang or the first mover, you know, are so appealing? Because it's like something, it's like, you know, the first, like, because things are getting more complex through history, because there seems to be a linear, or not linear, but a trajectory to human history.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think if you'd asked me that question a while ago, like years and years ago, I would have been like more skeptical of the idea of there being a trajectory to human history, but there clearly is one.
Mm.
There's at least one in the sense of things are getting more complex.
That much is evident.
That much is just evident. Mm-hmm. So it's like, and I really believe that we're able to be moral now in ways that we weren't in the past. Like if you read Steven Pinker, Better Angels of Our Nature, you look at the way people behaved back then, they had the same human nature. And I say back then, it's like almost at any other point in history.
Yep.
And while things get worse as well as getting better, and, you know, I do worry that we're in a time that things are getting worse now in a lot of ways, as probably people of every generation, let's admit it, have. But,
yeah.
I mean, like, you know, we all have challenges in our time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, World War II was less than 100 years ago. So sometimes the challenges can get worse and more difficult. But I think that at the end of the day, there is that trajectory, that there is this moral progress that people have had. Like they say that almost every human culture did sacrifice of humans, not just animals,
right,
but humans at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And they learned that it was bad and they put it aside. Now,
I'm not to judge someone
in a different culture, but they just observed. To clarify what I was saying there, it's like I'm not saying that human sacrifice is good, but you have to understand this is just a stage that cultures go through, and it's one thing for modern people to sneer at things that happened in the distant past, and we do that all the time, but it's like society evolves and people evolve. And, you know, I think what Steven Pinker was trying to say in The Better Angels of Our Nature is that as we evolve,
mm-hmm.
it's because certain ideas are advancing that are allowing us to do that, mm-hmm. you know, and we are in a place where there is less hurt of at least certain kinds in the world.
Yeah.
And that's allowed us to, you know, achieve the progress that we had. I go on and say what you were saying. I just didn't want
clarification
to be lost.
Well, so of course there's this moral progress, and it's, you know, it's not just, you can't just observe the world and observe morality.
No.
It is through trial and error. And, you know, you would have been a heretic to say that at a certain point in time, you would have been a heretic to say everything that we hold to be true right now. If you were,
absolutely.
If you were to say the earth is round,
yes,
burned. If mm-hmm. you were to say human sacrifice is bad,
yeah,
you were sacrificed. So I think a lot of, and myself included, we need to understand is that we will be as equally wrong.
Mm.
As equally wrong as the people in the year 423, as you know, it just given the amount, give the amount of required time
mm-hmm.
to proceed in the future, and then we will be proven to be as equally wrong.
You know what? It's true, and I think that's where a kind of a paranoia, frankly, creeps in with people now.
Hmm.
They don't want to be in the wrong side of history, and I get it.
Yes,
I get it, but it's like, you also need to live in the moment and be like, well, what makes sense at the moment? But mm-hmm. it's a really hard balance to make, because you want to embrace an aspect of moral progress because it's the right thing to do
mm-hmm.
genuinely, and is genuinely the direction of the future, and not just because, oh, I'm afraid I might be doing something terrible. Now, fear is a good motivator, but it's incomplete. Because then you get into a state of paranoia, and it's like, well, I don't want to be on the wrong side of history. I don't want to be on the wrong side of history.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I think that making a decision in fear is a bad thing.
I agree completely.
Yeah.
I agree. I think fear is a terrible thing. You know, obviously it has its biological advantages.
Yeah.
You know, as early as you can come to, in life, within your life, as early as you can come to terms with the fact that you're going to die, you don't know when you're going to die, mm-hmm. and then, like, you really have to try and stamp out that fear, so that you can go and live on a higher plane, mm-hmm. on a higher vibrational level than fear.
Well,
with compassion and love.
Yeah, and I think that concern that we all have, like, oh, what's the consequence going to be for me in this real world? You know, that's the mindset that you get when you play dirty politics.
Mm.
That's the mindset that people had when maybe someone in their tribe was murdered in the distant past, and they thought, we have to kill every man, woman, and child in the opposite tribe, because if one of them survives, they'll get revenge.
Sure.
That was a kind of morality to them. That was an honor code that they were bound by.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, and you know, for the people in that society, for the survival of that tribe, maybe, you know, in terms of the world they were living in at the time, that worked. But is that a good thing? No. Like, that's us. That's not, to reference the Gnostic stuff we were talking about, that's not the way it would be done in the Pleroma. That's not
in the ideal.
In the ideal world.
Yes.
It's the way that you do things when you're bogged down in the demands of the world now. It's like, you know, I want to endorse this moral cause, but it doesn't make practical sense, and I'm going to be pushed back against to a ridiculous degree for doing it, and on and on and on. And so therefore, we shouldn't do it right now.
Mm.
You know, people say that, and not for any bad reason. It's mm-hmm. for very good reasons that people say stuff like that. But it does sometimes shackle you.
Well, it certainly does. And like, if you were to just you know, boldly live in your truth and only, you know, have your highest good as truth, you might end up being a martyr.
Yes.
And that's terrifying if you have a family mm-hmm. and loved ones, and that's, you know, we fall short of that ideal.
Yes, absolutely.
Because of the fear.
Mm-hmm.
because we think we know what's best.
Well, I think in some cases you can do more good in the long run by keeping these practical concerns in mind.
Mm.
But we can't ever get to the point where we think that it is the ideal thing to do. I think, right, you know, there always needs to be a part of you that recognizes things are not as they should be. But people have done shameful things in history,
mm-hmm,
because they had practical concerns. Things like delaying the abolition of the slave trade.
Right.
They did that for practical concerns. And that is definitely not the kind of thing that anybody wants to do, mm-hmm, regardless of how good the argument is for it. So there are clearly some things where you have to sit back and say, no, I need to be idealistic. I, mm-hmm, need to maybe be a martyr here. And I think sometimes people find that they have that in them in circumstances that, you know, will surprise them.
Hmm.
You know, you don't want to die on the wrong hill.
Right. That's a big concern.
Yes, that's a very big concern. But, like, you know, you might actually come to a place where you decide, yes, that, you know, I might stake myself on this. And you might not be a martyr. You might be uplifted because you've said something courageous that inspires people.
You look at, and there's very few examples where you will literally be crucified for it, where, yeah, you will literally become a martyr for it. Mm-hmm. And you look at some examples, and I'm not even, you know, obviously I feel a certain way, but right or wrong, you look at Jordan Peterson speaking out. He's, mm-hmm, become absolutely famous and wealthy.
Yeah.
For dying on a hill.
Yeah.
You look at Brett Weinstein, you know, died on a hill. And I don't know if he's become as wealthy, but he's certainly become more prominent, and he gets to have,
right,
the type of intellectual discussions that he so craves, I'm sure, as an intellectual.
Well, I mean, he's died on a couple of hills.
And
I don't know what to say about him. I know there was that Evergreen College,
yeah,
thing where, you know, they said, you know, white teachers shouldn't come to school, I think.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, that might be an appropriate hill to die on and say, maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Like, in his mind, it was, you don't want to be racist. So, mm-hmm, so.
Well, I mean, that's a good thing to be afraid of, because that is a scourge. That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that people should be anti-racist and try to be anti-racist, but they shouldn't be anti-racist through the lens of us versus them. I think that's my problem personally, mm, with the activism you see today.
Mm.
I think racism, sure, is a terrible scourge.
Of course.
And we do have it unconsciously, not in every single one of us. It's not like, you know, it's like this evil festering force that, like, corrupts every part of our souls. That's not what I mean. I mean that, like, most people have an in-group bias, mm, and this is not a good thing, and we need to be aware of that so that we aren't acting in a bad or prejudicial manner. I think what's gone wrong is when it's turned into this us versus them thing, rather than racism is really bad, let's not be racist. Because I would hope that everyone would get behind that message.
Of course, of, right, course, yes.
Yeah, and I think that in general, whether it's any kind of prejudice, whether it's racism, sexism, homophobia, any of the isms, mm-hmm, we need to get towards reducing the prejudice, not us versus them.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a different game those people are playing.
Right.
They're not in the project of converting people.
Right.
Like to you know, the I forget his name, black fellow who goes and sits down with literal members of the KKK,
wow,
and collects their hoods after having a conversation with them and converting them.
Wow.
That is the project that we should be applauding.
Absolutely.
That type of thing.
Yes.
You know, he's not, it's very easy to say Nazis are bad, racists are bad.
Yes.
Everyone agrees with,
right,
you, except the Nazis and the racists.
Right.
So you're not actually converting them.
You're not. You need to engage with the people that have those prejudices and that obviously are held down by those sorts of things. And I think it's also like what you do in practice. Like, somebody that spouts slogans about feminism is not as high as someone who does the work.
Yes.
And is like, I don't want my wife or girlfriend to do all the washing up or something like mm-hmm. that, or to be pressured to put all of this effort into appearance or something like that. Someone that walks the walk.
Yes.
That's someone that's, it's not someone that spouts slogans. It's somebody that cares about making the world more equal in that way.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
Yeah.
100%. That's,
so it's someone who vacuums around the house, basically, is, yeah. is what I'm saying, and actually cleans up after themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's not to say that there isn't a place for the ideas,
yeah.
because there certainly is.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, action and action that has the intended result and a good result is so much more commendable than mm-hmm. than ideas.
Yeah, it is, because action is, I think, like what you're willing to stick with. You know, I stake my life on this.
Mm.
You know, I am behaving in this way, you mm-hmm. know, because this is what I believe in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's really respectable in people. Like, people sense when things are just words.
Mm-hmm.
They sense when something is just prattle. But when somebody actually, you know, does their due diligence and acts in a way that's admirable
mm-hmm.
and commendable, that's when things go well.
Yeah. And we don't, you can't help but look up to those people.
No, absolutely not. You can't help it, because it's somebody that often, you know, is doing it at great risk to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes that's what you have to lose. Not that an action becomes more moral because you have less to lose. If it's a good thing, it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not tested mm-hmm. unless you're in a situation where you have a lot to lose.
Sure.
I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Interesting.
And I think, like, also perspective taking.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, like, if you're engaged with somebody and, you know, you consider them an ideological opponent.
Okay.
You're like, all right, why are they acting this way? Is it understandable that they might act in that way?
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you do that, then you know what's motivating them. So you address their concern.
Right.
So that's getting away from the us versus them. That's like, I want to talk to you in a way that helps you and that lifts you up.
Mm-hmm.
I think people want that in general now. I think that yes. people aren't getting good faith conversations with people.
Fewer and fewer.
Fewer and fewer.
You see on social media, you see.
It's devolved into a war.
Yeah, where you're simply just strawmanning the other person's...
Exactly.
You're not even, like, you see people post things on social media. One, they're not even actually engaged with anyone.
Yeah.
Two, they're 9 times out of 10 strawmanning the other person's view or mm-hmm. their perception of the other ideological right. side's
yes.
view, mm-hmm. and it's simply drawing division.
Yeah,
because even your ideological opponent doesn't agree with
right.
You know, and that's why I love debates where you have to steel man the other person's case.
Yes,
and then. And then they both work on that case together.
Yeah,
and then you both work on your case together. Yes. It's brilliant.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think in cases where you're steel manning, you also kind of reveal that you want to not just win a debate, but be right.
Yes.
And that's a really different from a lot of other debates and arguments that people have. When you're steel manning someone, it's like, well, you know, I want to see maybe if you're right, you know, so let's defend your argument. Let's try and, you know, make it strong
mm-hmm.
so that, you know, I can see what's good in it and, you know, maybe take that on myself. You know, if you steel man someone's argument and it's really, really good and you can't think of objections to it, maybe somebody else will,
mm-hmm.
But like, maybe you're like, oh, you know, maybe I should change my perspective on that.
Yeah.
You know, if that makes any sense, I think like a debate is set up too often in our world as a way of convincing the minds of the audience, but not the people in it. But the people in it, they don't have open minds necessarily. They debate, they've got these two people on two sides or a group of people that are, you know, up against each other, and they go at it.
Mm-hmm. And they try and just get the bigger applause.
That's grandstanding. Yep. That is not being correct.
Mm-hmm.
You can win an argument and not be right, And that's very often what happens there, especially if you're playing to the room. Like the room likes what you're saying. Oh, yeah, but you're not necessarily speaking the truth.
Yep.
It's like, what is the truth? What about finding that? And then maybe living, as you say, your life in accordance with that. And then again, as we were saying earlier, if you bump into reality and, you know, things aren't working out, you adjust your behavior.
Right.
And you don't act like that anymore.
No, absolutely. And for as far as steel manning someone else's case, then you're expediting the process where you don't have to just give the rebuttal. And then a week later, they think of the rebuttal. You've already helped them think through multiple stages, and you try and get to the kernel of the disagreement and work that out.
Yes.
Do you think there are contradictions?
In reality?
In reality or...
It's a good question. I mean...
Or is it just, it's not a whole picture?
I think most likely it's not the whole picture, but I'm fighting with very different sides of myself here and with very different influences and with people who have tried to convince me of very different ways of approaching life. And I still don't know the answer to that question, except to say that, you know, we do conceive of life as having contradictions in it. And I think that human beings are really weird in that way. We kind of accept that life has contradictions in it. What I think is bad is when people don't live out their principles. Because even though, you know, the situation you're in might demand a different action and, you know, that might be justified and all of that. When someone's not living out their principles and not being consistent with them, it often applies that they're doing it for purely self-serving reasons. It's like these rules apply in this situation, but not the other situation.
Yeah, doing what is expedient.
Yeah, exactly. Doing what is expedient and not which is that which is true or that which is good or what have you. And we should be looking for the latter. And also looking for what the grain of truth is in what someone is saying. It's like, even if you don't agree with them, it's like, look, you're trying to make a certain point and there's something in it that maybe I'm not fully taking into account. I don't know if you can think of any examples like that.
No, I mean, like, I'm sure there's a lot of examples, you know, where you're thinking on different levels and different levels of analysis and different resolutions of the problem, and so often you just bulldoze the person, because you know they're not thinking at the same level of analysis, but you know maybe they are really thinking about a problem, and maybe the problem is greater than you give it credit. I wonder what a good example would be. I mean, maybe not like the, I don't know, the climate issue is a big one. Like that is, if, you know, obviously there is a problem there. Maybe not, but there's,
and then, I think there is. That's actually my opinion, that there actually is something going on there, that it's not just people freaking out.
Right. And so most people can agree on that. That's about it.
Right.
Like what to do? That is an insurmountable task.
I think we need to work on our attitudes towards that, because you find that people on both sides of the political spectrum have opinions on climate change based on their political affiliation.
Yes.
And not on science.
Yes.
That's what Steven Pinker says. That's shameful and shocking. We should not be in that position. We should be in a position where we look at the science and try to decide what to do after we have the facts.
Right.
But we're not like that as humans. That's this rationalistic, dispassionate robot. That's not a human being.
Right.
But the scientific hat is a hat that we can put on. Now, I'm not a scientist, but like I think that when it comes to even just looking at what data you can get access to in your daily life, you know, if you break it down and try and make sense of what you see in front of you and, you know, be really skeptical, you can get somewhere, be like, why do I want this to be true? Why do I not want this to be true? You know, what kind of interpretive bias might the people behind it have.
Right.
And, you know, you might come to a very different conclusion mm-hmm. than someone else looking at the same data. Like when it comes to the pandemic, risk tolerance is different for everybody. Some people will look at the numbers and be like, well, this is a very low death rate. Mm-hmm. So why are we freaking out? And someone else is like, well, you know, God, I don't want to go out. I want to, you know, stay here and I want to protect myself. And, you know, they're looking at exactly the same numbers.
Sure.
But they're coming to very different conclusions. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to that, I think there's some freedom. When it comes to making decisions on a global or national level about it, like, let's say, also, you know, with regards to pandemic, but more with government policy on the pandemic, or with climate change, you actually have to come to a decision that factors different benefits and costs against each other.
Right.
And that's very hard to do because people have an investment in these debates. Mm-hmm. And, you know, honestly, I don't trust myself
yep.
even to get to the bottom of them.
I don't either.
I have been very frustrated during the pandemic because I've been trying to figure out, okay, what does the science really say? Mm-hmm. And I've had people try to convince me of all sorts of different things on both sides. And you dig in further and you find something that surprises you. You're like, okay, so this article that this person sent me has nothing to do with vaccine safety. It has to do with whether or not alternative treatments work. But that's not the question I'm trying to ask.
Right.
Because people have entire worldviews mm-hmm. that they are pushing here. If
yes.
If you are against lockdowns, you tend to often be against mandatory vaccines mm-hmm. or and vaccine passports and stuff like that. Now, I'm not a big fan of mandating things myself. For myself, you know, I've tried to do what I feel is best for me, and
well, that's all we can do,
and exactly, and that's all we can do, and you know, try to come to the decisions that work for me as an individual, not with no regard to public well-being or anything like that, but just like honestly trying to look at it, because there are people that freak out when they think that you're going to take a vaccine. And there's people that are going to freak out when they think that you're going outside and you're exposing yourself to too many cases or something like that. And I've had people fear for me for all sorts of different reasons.
Yes.
And it's like, if I were to listen to all of them 100% of the time, I couldn't live.
Mm-hmm.
I need to actually look at the data and come to my own decisions. And it turns out to be hard. It's actually not as straightforward as anyone thinks, because people have agendas.
Right, right. And so I would like I completely agree with that, and it's so incredibly hard to do, as I always say, it's so incredibly hard to do just for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I am myself.
Yeah.
I'm the one making the decision for myself. So just the hubris to think you know what is best for another person
mm-hmm.
is staggering.
Right.
It's staggering. And, you know, along those debates, some people are, and I think it's just very tough to articulate, some people are wanting to debate the science on one side, and some people are saying, I don't care what the science is.
Yeah.
This is not I'm concerned about the government.
Right.
This is they're having two totally different things.
This isn't 1930s Germany.
Sure.
What should people be concerned?
Mm.
Yes, people should be concerned about government overreach. Whatever you think about health measures, whatever you think about vaccines, pandemic, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
I think people should be concerned about that. Just because in general, if you take power away or you're violating a certain agreed upon norm with regards to the use of government power,
mm-hmm.
it's hard to get it back.
Right.
And I know that there's these different personalities that we were talking about the other day,
yeah.
but I have faith that most people don't want that. They do not want a government to seize complete power,
of course.
You know, over people's lives.
I certainly agree with that.
Yeah.
I certainly agree with that. The problem is that I think most people have always wanted that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet,
yeah.
It's happened.
Yes.
So, to go back to the point, is some people are concerned about that.
Yes.
And some people are concerned about the efficacy of the vaccine.
Right.
And they're not having the same conversation.
They're not having the same conversation at all. Like, I think that there are these meta conversations going on right now where, you know, you're in favor of this, 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 and this. And that's this doctor that I was referencing. Again, I think it's Zamatier or something like that. Mm. But anyway, he was saying that this is the antithesis tribe, let's say, that says, you know, the myocarditis is highly, highly underreported. Vaccines might well have been forced on this as a kind of a gigantic experimental thing. Mm-hmm. Hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin work. The pandemic is not as serious as is often claimed in terms of the number of deaths or even number of cases and these sorts of things. And then also typically anti-mask mm-hmm. and often think that vaccines do nothing to slow transmission. Although this is, that's a tangled debate.
Sure.
Because.
But that's all one basket.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the other basket says, you know, this is absolutely something serious that we should be paying attention to. It's heartless to dwell on the fact that it's mostly old people that are dying of it. You know, locking down prevents large amounts of people from getting sick and prevents people from overflowing, you know, into mm-hmm. the hospitals and stuff like that. And we need to lock down in order to stop that. And while maybe authoritarianism and all that stuff is bad, you know, this is just an emergency situation. And in this particular instance, we just really have to lock down and, you know, get everybody to, you know, shut themselves away and just do anything that they can to slow the transmission. Mm. And the vaccines are safe and effective. Mm-hmm. And the number of people that have a strong reaction to them is just so small that, you know, you might as well not even worry about it.
Right.
So these camps are the two camps that are doing battle. And I sense that something is off about this because while in terms of political personalities, it makes sense that certain traits would go together for, you know, from a left wing or right wing perspective. And
sure.
it makes sense why you would believe this thing and all these other things.
Yes.
In this circumstance, it actually doesn't make sense that people have to believe all of these things.
Right.
And I think the reason why is partly because social media has siloed us away
mm-hmm.
and also because people promoting the thesis side of it are caught up in, not all the time, but very often in a system where it's like somebody that's not doing it is endangering others. And, you know, they're kind of a liability, you know, people are dying as a result of them. So, you know, this isn't just a normal disagreement. So then everybody that doesn't agree completely with the thesis side ends up in the antithesis side. They don't trust anything that the thesis side says,
right.
And they get caught up in some really extreme beliefs, like, you know, the vaccine is going to change our DNA and turn us all into elephants or something like this.
Yeah.
You know, there are people that believe something pretty close to that.
Turn the frogs gay.
Right. Exactly. And it's like, and this is a kind of a problem. Like I was trying to get information on whether or not a close genetic relative of ours who had a reaction mm-hmm. to the vaccine mm-hmm. Was going to impact my risk. And I know that doctors are not oracles and they don't have all the information.
In the sense that you are a close genetic relative.
Yes, in the sense that I'm a close genetic relative, not in a general way.
Yep.
Because the way I saw it was either this is the myocarditis stuff is really rare and the fact that I'm related to someone that had a reaction means that I have a very good chance of a reaction.
Sure.
Or on the other hand, it implies that it's not as rare as people have been saying and, you know, the cases of exceptions are underreported. And in either way, I need to figure out what's going on. So I wanted to read the data.
Mm.
And I found more just doing research myself. Where I discovered that there did seem to be a genetic link there, you know, in terms of the allergic reaction to the vaccine. And none of the doctors were of any help. A lot of the nurses, you know, were very concerned. They were worried.
Yes.
But, you know, you would talk to the doctors and they would just give you the same stats as they're often trained to do in terms of what the risks are and what the benefits are and all of that. And I'm like, I don't want to know about that stuff. I know that in absolute terms, it's highly unlikely that something is going to happen to me. I'm just saying because I'm related to someone who had a reaction, I just want to know more.
Right.
And I never found out enough. So I was just forced to, you know, make a decision based on that very small amount of information.
Yeah, I think that, but I think that, so maybe to shift gears here, that speaks to the problem of the individual always,
mm-hmm.
because the dice are loaded.
Yes.
For the individual.
Mm-hmm.
You're not the average.
Mm-hmm.
You are, I don't want to say nothing to do with the average, but you're one point.
That's right.
And you will land on the graph as that one point.
Yes.
So it's, you know, that's why we have to take radical responsibility for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if you look at the average of everything, you could be wrong all the time because mm-hmm. your point might be here on the graph, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, I mean, I think that we all come from very different backgrounds, very different perspectives, and we all have something to contribute to society.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the fact that we all have different perspectives, yes, it can be a liability and it means that we're likely to be wrong about most things,
mm-hmm.
but it also means we're in a unique position to be right about something,
mm-hmm.
or to, you know, shine a light somewhere maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's, I think we need to be positive about it. Like, yeah, be mindful about the fact we can be wrong, but still be courageous and go forward into the world and, you know, be like, yeah, you know, as an individual, I might make some bad choices,
mm-hmm.
and you know, that's perfectly fine, because you know, that's a risk I'm just prepared to take.
Yes, and I do agree with limited, like, make those choices for yourself,
mm-hmm.
and but to, you know, when you advocate for the use of force against others, the exposure to potential downside for society is huge.
Yes.
Whereas when you're just making a decision for yourself,
mm-hmm.
you're the one who's going to pay the price either way.
Yeah. And then, you know, what else is fair? It's not fair to drag someone else down for something that you've done. It's going to happen. You know, we're responsible for other people. We're responsible to, you know, clean up a situation, or at least, you know, the world is going to be helped if we do, if someone else has messed something up. But, you know, people need to take individual responsibility too, because none of us are capable of shouldering the burden of the entire world and cleaning up after everybody else's mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be us.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the responsibility to maybe sometimes undo the harm that we've done. And, you know, that's hard.
Mm-hmm.
That's very hard. You know, I think in general, the decisions that we make are based on what will allow us to thrive. And sometimes that could be, as long as in a healthy way, what makes other people comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's what makes us comfortable, and we have to put up boundaries and, you know, not feel the urge to over-explain ourselves. I find that I have that urge.
To over-explain yourself?
Absolutely.
Hmm.
I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the way I was raised, or, you know, things that I encountered when I was growing up, or maybe it's part of my personality.
Hmm.
But I feel the urge to explain myself, and I feel like I shouldn't need to do that as much.
Right. So I've thought about this before. And then I always come, the answer I come to is the other people don't even care,
mm-hmm.
most of the time.
No.
You know, the thing that you're over explaining, they're not even thinking about.
Yeah, 99 times out of 100.
Yeah, yeah. Like you could have done the goofiest thing and, you know, that you, oh, this person probably thinks, da 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 da. And they're thinking about their tax return.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, I understand that. I sometimes struggle with it too. You know, and it's just and to that end, I admire people who can just kind of bulldoze a little bit more through life, and by doing that are more efficient at achieving their goals.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And not be concerned about what this person thinks, what that person thinks. Because quite aside from just the fact that you're going to get more done that way, you also miss opportunities that way.
Mm.
If you, you know, wait too long or kind of prevaricate, you stop yourself from taking advantage of moments that are very precious and that you can only access in real time.
Mm.
And I mean, I know that's happened to me in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure it's a universal experience.
Yes.
Like, you know, we all know these things that we could have taken advantage of and that we didn't do. And, you know, ultimately you can't regret that either. You have to just go forward.
Yes.
And just be like, you know, I'm me. I'm responsible for who I am in the moment. And, you know, the sum total of all the decisions that I've made. Yeah. And I have to live with them.
Right. And because you can't, like, as I was saying before, the data set is infinite.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't analyze the infinite data set before you make a decision.
No.
And Alan Watts would say, when you make a decision, you know, you give yourself the illusion that you've analyzed enough data and now it's time to make the decision.
Yeah.
But he goes, really, you're just flipping the coin every time.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We do riskier things every day.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's funny. Like driving in a snowstorm 3 hours from North Bay to Milton is risky.
It is risky. Although the snowstorm didn't last as long as you might have thought. But yeah, I know it's really funny, you know, again, not to talk about the pandemic endlessly, but like the risk that we take driving is worse than the risk of dying of COVID or dying of a vaccine reaction or what have you, you know, almost anything that you could experience as a result of this. And yet we go out and we drive. So, you know, cost benefit analysis, you know, take everything into account and, you know, make your decision based on the complete picture, not just a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And respect other people's risk tolerance, you know, whether it's a very large amount of tolerance or a very small amount of tolerance.
Yep. And we do that, and we do that in you know, we should do that in all other aspects of life, you know.
Yeah.
People have different preferences and different risk tolerances for everything. And
yeah.
To switch gears, because I most enjoy talking to you about spiritual things or religious things, do you have a practice? Do you feel the need to have a practice? Do you meditate?
Well, you know, it's really funny because I have been trying to sort of clear my mind recently of anxiety, not so much through meditation, but because I believe that over the course of my life, I've had so much anxiety in it and so much depression and things like that, that it's kind of numbed me as a side effect.
Mm.
So what I'm trying to do is reduce the anxiety to feel more connected to the world. Mm-hmm. And so I need to be more aware of my emotions, I think, as a person, and be aware of where I'm suppressing them. Not on purpose and not because I enjoy it, but just as a kind of a reaction to all of the...
Yeah, coping mechanism.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The things that weigh us down in life, and just be more connected to the physical world.
Yes.
And you know, that physical reality.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's sometimes just being in nature and paying attention to the smells, the sights, you know, turning off not so much your mind, but what we think of as our minds.
Mm.
The like part the that thoughts. Analyzes everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. That's a better answer than I could have imagined. Because yeah, I think everyone to differing degrees does that.
Yes.
And because it is probably the most effective coping mechanism to not feel things so deeply.
Yeah. And it's not always one that we choose.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the interesting thing. Like, there's a lot of people that do choose it. They're like, you know, I just want to shut my emotions off. But I don't actually think that, like, most people that end up in that state chronically want to be there. They find it distressing in a weird way because, you know, they're numb. So why would they find it distressing? But it's like, it's like something that you practice because you find the world too overwhelming.
Mm.
And what you need to do is break out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just anything that that I think helps you accomplish that is positive. And mean for me, what I try and do is connect to nature, and you know, just whether it's just lingering, letting my eyes linger on a beautiful scene or something like that, or you know, and again, smelling and things like that, touch, because touch is unique in that it's the only one of our five senses that's not based in the head.
Yes.
Because you see through your eyes up here, your ears, your nose, your mouth, it's all up here in the head. And most people have always felt, I think.
Heady.
And that, you know, their mind is up here.
That they're the little man.
Yes, that's right. The homunculus.
Yeah.
But there's one sense that's all over our body, and that's touch. And I think that's the sense that's connected to the emotions. I think that's it. I mean, again, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a biologist or anything
like that.
But just in a commonsensical way, I think that's true.
I think that's a great thing to work on. Yes, to get out of your mind. And for me, it's through physical activity.
Yeah.
For me, for sure. You know, there's nothing that calms me more than cardio, than going for a run or a long bike ride, and afterwards. It is just pure, it is so peaceful.
Yeah.
So incredibly peaceful. And even during sometimes really inhabiting the muscle when it's happening. Like I can inhabit my legs sometimes on a long bike ride.
Yeah.
And it's just a shift of the location of my consciousness to somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I'd like, and I asked that because I want to meditate.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's hard. Like the kind of clear your mind thing, I don't like that way of looking at it, because so often the kind of dissociation that you go through when you're in a very numb state is a kind of a mind clearing in and of itself. So I don't like that. I like being less analytical. I think that's the way of looking at it, you know, being more in tune with your body and your surroundings and your emotions and stuff like that. I think that's the emphasis you should put on it, or that's the emphasis you should have.
Have you ever had a spiritual experience?
You know,
or a religious experience?
Yes, but
you don't have to talk about it.
It's a hard thing to talk about. Yeah, no, I don't know if I want to get into it.
No, right, fair now. Enough. Yeah. It's one of those things. It's I don't how do you describe it? Like how you know, to me the most readily available example of it that I always think of, maybe like peak spiritual experience is Saul becoming Paul.
The vision on the road to Damascus.
Where he was just struck.
Right.
And just blinded and just completely annihilated by the truth, the light, or the light. Or
The Logos.
Logos,
Yeah.
Like that is something that it's kind of like, it'd be scary to voluntarily commit yourself to something like that.
Absolutely.
But it, on all accounts, it seems worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
You listen to Ram Dass, Richard Alpert. Do you listen to any of his stuff?
Or I have listened to some Ram Dass. It's been a while, but I'm aware of him, yes.
Because he always talks, and maybe this is a completely different set of issues, because he's so good about being self-deprecating and talking about his what would he call them? Neuroses.
Yes.
He'd talk about his neuroses.
Yes.
And he's for anyone who doesn't know, he's a psychologist, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, he would, his whole professional career was trying to dissect the neuroses until they went away.
Yeah.
And then his later intellectual journey led him to become whatever Hindu or whatever everything journey to the East, and his conclusion there was just let it go, and his neuroses became like the grain of salt in the water, and just became what made life interesting, but letting it go. I don't know. It's Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the idea of inhabiting in getting out of your mind.
Absolutely.
At least as the visualization of where your consciousness sits.
Yeah, exactly. And kind of realizing that there's no actual division between me and you or us, even in that table and all of that stuff. This sounds really hippie.
Mm.
This sounds like a really hippie-ish thing to say. But it's like we're all made of matter, and that matter is all based on waves of energy, mm-hmm. you know, and particles and stuff like that, you know, microparticles all the way down. There's just a narrowing of bandwidth between my consciousness, your consciousness, the consciousness of everyone else. And yet it's still possible to communicate between us. So the bandwidth is just low. It's not nothing, you know, and I think that's where you get synchronicity from, you know, those mystical connections that people have all over the world. Like you were saying the other day about a mouse learning something mm. in one part of the world and then another mouse learning to do something in another part of the world that no mouse has ever done at almost exactly the same time. There's this subtle communication that we've had even before the internet. I think the internet just channeled and made more powerful something that was already there in our world.
And is that Jung's collective subconscious?
Yeah, I think he was gesturing at that, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like I was using the word synchronicity, which is obviously a word that Jung used. So,
mm.
But there's also the collective unconscious that's like a human being's unconscious as a group, if that makes any sense. Like the kind of things that we do as a group and the kind of, you know, intuitions that we have as a group, if that makes any sense.
Right. Mm-hmm. Do you find... we were talking earlier about the meaning and mm-hmm. the flow state. However, I think there's a continuum of where you can land on that. Do you find conversation like this puts you in that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's a great excuse, you know, to kind of talk about these things, you know, because they build up and, you know, more often than not, people think that other people aren't interested in having these sorts of quote unquote deep conversations.
Mm.
But I think that's less true now than it was 10 years ago. People aren't as self-aware of it as they were 10 years ago when they have conversations like this, because people are having them on podcasts like this all the time. And people have learned, I think there's an appetite.
Massive
appetite for this type of thing. So, I do think this kind of thing puts me in a flow state because, you know, it's, I think I hope we both, you know, really want to explore what is true and to push beyond the boundaries of what we currently, you know, believe in or value or understand to be there in the world. And, I think when you have that energy going between two or more people and, you know, you're caught in a conversation, it keeps building up. There is this natural flow state because when you fall behind, you know, the other person might come in and say something.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we can kind of bounce ideas off each other. And then it's the idea itself that has life. It's like the conversation is the main character in this podcast. It's not us.
Yes. I like that. Yeah. I think, yeah. You know, and there's, I don't know, like, yeah, I think it's more common, maybe more common than not. I don't know. But I guess people are just different. People are interested in different things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my favorite thing to do at a party is to go find the other person.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. and there's one or two other people that you can have mm-hmm. that conversation with.
Yes.
And really connect with. And then people... Yeah, there's different things.
Yeah.
Well, we've been going for almost 2 hours now.
Well.
We run out of things to talk about?
I don't think we've run out of things to talk about. We will get into more, though, on another day or later on.
John, I so appreciate you coming down. I've probably said it before.
I
love having these conversations with you.
Same here.
And we'll do more.
Definitely.
Thanks. If you enjoyed the podcast, give it a like and share it with some friends. See you guys next week.